Russia begins its mass coronavirus vaccination using its own vaccine, Sputnik V, which developers say enjoys a 95% efficacy. The U.S. terminates several cultural exchange programs with China amid growing tensions between the two countries. And Qatar rules out normalization of ties with Israel at present, saying that it remains committed to the creation of a Palestinian state. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Russia has begun its mass coronavirus vaccination using the homegrown vaccine Sputnik V. Health officials say that they have opened 70 vaccination clinics in the capital, Moscow, the hotspot of the infections in the country. The Coronavirus Task Force says the vaccine will be delivered first to the groups at risk of becoming infected, including medical workers, teachers, and social workers. The vaccine is administered in two injections, with a second dose expected to be given 21 days after the first. Developers of Sputnik V say that it is 95% effective and causes no major side effects. However, the fast process of its development has raised concerns about its safety. Russia has so far registered more than 2.4 million infections, which is the fourth highest in the world. Marina Kartanova is a correspondent joining us from Moscow. Marina, this is, I'm guessing, very good news, obviously, for Russia and maybe the wider world. Tell us the rollout process here and what we can expect.
Good afternoon. So, well, all Russian regions to join these vaccination campaign by the next week. And vaccination of risk groups against coronavirus began in Moscow today. So we are the capital, and the most amount of sick people are here. So as you mentioned before, while vaccination is available for employers of medical and educational institutions as well as city social organizations, the vaccination appointment opened on Friday, December 4th, and at the moment, citizens who are in contact with a large number of people can receive the Sputnik V vaccine. So they are teachers, employees of city services, employees of medical institutions, and the Moscovites can sign up for a free vaccination at one of 70 points here in Moscow. So vaccination points will be open from 8 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock in the evening, and the list of categories will be expanded after institutions receive new batches of vaccines. So according to the vaccination rules, an application for the procedure must be submitted on the Mosru portal. This is a common portal where we pay money for our houses, for most of their services here in the city. And this can only be done by those who are attached to the capital's clinics. Recording is available 2 weeks in advance. So you must come for the vaccination with a passport, a general health insurance policy, and a certificate from work work indicating your position. The whole process will take about an hour. First, a 10-minute examination by a doctor is carried out. Then the vaccine is thawed separately for the patient. This takes about 15 minutes, and after vaccination, doctors monitor a person's well-being for another 30 minutes. About 2 million doses of a vaccine had already been manufactured in the country. And according to the president, this gives an opportunity, if not to begin mass inoculation, then at least to roll it out on a large scale. It is planned the vaccination will begin with the first two risk groups, doctors and teachers. Presently, two domestically developed vaccines have been registered in Russia. One of them, Sputnik V, was developed by the Gamaleya National Research Center for Epidemiology and Microbiology of the Russian Health Ministry. The other one, Epivac Corona, was developed by the Vector Center in Siberia. And the third one, developed by the Chumakov Federal Scientific Center for Research and Development of Immune and Biological Products of the Russian Academy of Sciences. So the third one is expected to be registered soon. So mass vaccination in Russia, it is planned that mass vaccination in Russia will involve elderly people as well as those with chronic health issues or at risk groups.
Very well. Thank you for that. Marina Kortanova, correspondent there from Moscow. Moving on, Iran's president says the rising trend of coronavirus infections has lost steam in dozens of hotspots thanks to restrictions. Hassan Rouhani said the number of areas marked as red has reduced from 160 to 64. Red indicates the highest risk of infection. According to Rouhani, 96 cities and towns, including the capital Tehran, are now considered as orange, suggesting lower risk. The president noted that restrictive measures will be eased in areas where infection rates go down. Iran imposed a series of nationwide curbs 2 weeks ago in an effort to contain the spread of the virus. COVID-19 has killed nearly 50,000 people and infected more than a million since it emerged in Iran earlier this year. The coronavirus pandemic continues to take a heavy toll on the Americas, while the U.S. remains the most affected country on the continent. According to a tally by Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. set a new daily record of coronavirus cases in 24 hours, with more than 225,000 infections, pushed the total caseload to 14.3 million. It also reported over 2,500 new deaths, raising the overall toll to 278,000. Officials linked the new resurgence to the holiday season. In Brazil, the health ministry announced nearly 47,000 new cases, pushing the country's tally to more than 6.5 million. Mexico also registered more than 12,000 new cases and 690 fatalities. Mexican officials say the real number could be significantly higher than what is being reported due to little testing. The top UN health official has warned that 2021 is shaping up to be a humanitarian catastrophe, urging rich nations not to trample the poor in a, quote, stampede for COVID-19 vaccines.
With vaccines now being introduced, it's really important that they're distributed equitably around the world. Since Gavi, CEPI, and WHO set up the COVAX facility in April of this year, 189 countries and economies have backed it. WHO is engaged with our partners at all levels, working to boost manufacturing and ensure rollout of COVID-19 vaccines.
The WHO Director General also said that the solution to the global crisis must be shared equitably across the social strata. He emphasized the vaccines should not be treated as private commodities, but global public goods. He also talked about the vaccine rollout plans, where the WHO will help countries get their fair access to vaccines. Also, the UN top official David Beasley added that a dozen countries are on the brink of famine, leading to what he called the worst humanitarian crisis yet. On Wednesday, Britain became the first country to approve vaccination, followed by Russia. The U.S. has terminated five cultural exchange programs with China as tensions grow between the two countries. The State Department said the programs in question are fully funded and operated by Chinese government, dismissing them as, quote, soft power propaganda tools. Washington and Beijing have been embroiled in disputes over a range of issues, including trade, Hong Kong security, and the coronavirus pandemic in recent years. Tensions escalated further after the U.S. government blacklisted several Chinese firms, a move condemned by Beijing. The Chinese government has time and again accused the White House of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in Hong Kong and Taiwan affairs, as well as in the South China Sea.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has targeted more Chinese companies, accusing them of having ties with the country's military. China's top chip maker, SMIC, and oil giant, China National Offshore Oil Corporation, as well as two other firms, have been added to the so-called blacklist of the U.S. Defense Department. This comes amid escalating tensions between the world's two top economies on multiple fronts. China has slammed the move, saying it firmly opposes what it calls Washington's wanton operation of Chinese companies. Beijing says the measure will severely harm America's interest and image. A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman also urged Washington to, quote, stop abusing its national power and national security concepts to surpass foreign companies. Over the past weeks, several Chinese companies have been blacklisted under an executive order signed by Trump. Washington and Beijing have been at loggerheads over a host of issues ranging from trade, technology, security, human rights to COVID-19. That all intensified when Trump took office in 2017, with his administration launching a trade war with China, leading to a tit-for-tat tariffs measures. Since then, key Chinese industries, including telecoms giants Huawei and ZTE, as well as several social media apps, have also been targeted under different pretexts. Washington has also used the issues of Hong Kong and Taiwan to put more pressure on China. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. So why is the Trump administration keen on infuriating China? It seems the expanded blacklist is part of a bid to cement Trump's tough-on-China legacy before Democratic President-elect Joe Biden takes office on January the 20th.
I think this is definitely a part of a larger effort against China. The United States has to find another way of undermining China. Obviously, militarily, taking on China is a near impossible task. It would not be possible. The foot soldiers alone to occupy China just simply do not exist.
Relations between the world's two top economies have sunken to the lowest level since Trump's arrival in the White House. Just recently, even the Democrat-led House of Representatives passed a law to delist Chinese companies from stock exchange if they do not fully comply with the U.S. auditing rules, thus giving Trump one more tool to threaten Beijing before leaving office. But will Trump be able to inflict beyond repair damage to the Sino-U.S. relationship remains to be seen.
Qatar says it will not establish diplomatic relations with Israel until the Palestinian issue is resolved. Qatari Foreign Minister announced on Friday that the Palestinian issue needs to be at the heart of any normalization agreements with Israel. Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani said that a normalization deal between Doha and Tel Aviv at this time would not have any value for the people of Palestine. He said that his country will remain committed to the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative that offers ties with Israel in return for the regime's withdrawal from the occupied West Bank. The statements came amid speculations that Qatar would be the next Arab country to normalize ties with Israel after the UAE and Bahrain signed such an agreement 3 months ago. Sudan also agreed to establish ties with Israel in October. Tehran has once again called on the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal to fulfill their commitments under the 2015 nuclear accord. During our news review program, we discussed the future of the deal under Joe Biden administration in the U.S.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has called on European signatories to the nuclear deal to fulfill their commitments under the 2015 accord. Zarif also called on Germany to honor obligations and stop violating the agreement. He urged Berlin to end its malign behavior in West Asia and its support for Israel's terror. The top Iranian diplomat made the comments in reaction to remarks by his German counterpart, Heiko Maas, earlier Friday. Maas said that a new, broader nuclear deal is needed to rein in Iran's missile program. Maas added that they need this agreement because Germany does not trust Iran. Tehran has time and again stated its missile program and defensive capabilities are not up for negotiations. And now joining us for this news review is Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer from Westchester University, joining us from Westchester, and Keith Preston, journalist and researcher, joining us out of Richmond. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in Westchester with you, Larry. Welcome. It's good to have you back on the program and get your perspective on things. Your thoughts on the Germans' new take and approach on this thing with Tehran.
What makes them think that Tehran should trust the Germans? Okay? It's the what Germany has done is essentially opted for the protection of certain elements of their economy, certain companies, who have decided to follow suit with the American sanctions, because the Americans say, if you don't sanction the Iranians, if you don't go along with our sanctions, we sanction you. So there's German companies that don't want to do that. And the German government has essentially said, okay, you know, we will not follow our contractual obligations as far as Iran goes. And now you've got this German diplomat saying, oh, we don't trust Iran. What is that? It's Iran who shouldn't trust the Germans. or any of these other countries who say, we won't be held to our contractual obligations, our treaty obligations, because the Americans are threatening elements of our economy. And so there you go.
Thank you, Lawrence.
So where is ethics?
Keith, I want to welcome you to the program, but your take on this, Keith, how does this whole thing, how does it smell like to you?
Well, one thing we should remember is that when we're looking at the foreign policy positions of Germany, or really any of the European states, we have to consider the degree to which they are subservient to the United States. We have to remember that all of the majority of the European states are essentially under the military umbrella of NATO, which is really just the European arm of the American military-industrial complex. So these countries in Western Europe really do not act independently when it comes to their own foreign policy objectives. Now, there may be some degree of leeway that they possess about certain things, and of course the Americans are always lambasting them for not being reliable allies. But if you actually look at the foreign policy positions that most of the European states have taken, particularly the Western European states, in recent decades, particularly on major issues like matters of war and peace, and in particular when you look at Germany's foreign policy history, what you see is that Germany has almost always done the bidding of the United States, whether directly or indirectly. I mean, we've seen that time and time again with Germany's involvement in the Kosovo War in 1999 at the behest of the United States, Germany's support for the NATO act of aggression against Libya in 2011, just to name a couple of examples. We've seen this repeatedly. So it's also important to recognize that the United States will often use indirect methods of coercion in order to pursue its own foreign policy objectives. So the United States has its own sanctions that it has imposed on Tehran, but we also see that the United States has the means of coercing Germany into complying with the American objectives as far as the sanctions as well. So Germany is not acting in a fully independent manner. And for that reason, the previous speaker is absolutely correct that why should Iran trust the Germans when the Germans are essentially acting on behalf of the Americans? And the Americans have greatly escalated their rhetorical hostility and in fact, their direct military hostility to Iran during the course of the past year or so, in the last couple of years of the Trump administration. So there's no reason whatsoever why Iran should take anything Germany is saying at face value.
All right, gentlemen, time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Do stay safe until we see both of you again. Lawrence Davidson from Westchester, Pennsylvania, and Keith Preston there joining us out of Richmond. And that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
Aperture.
Depleted uranium made a spectacular entrance on the battlefront in 1991. During the first Persian Gulf War, bombs and shells made with this high-density metal annihilated Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium, and experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, A Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet, or you put it on the end of a shell, and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey, guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse because, you know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. On July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the US and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. Depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could you tell us about leaving Kuwait? How it happened for you?
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this, the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started, and at that time I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer, particularly in this hospital. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, we found there is an increase of, say, fourfold. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security. And he knows about the problem, and he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that they got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad Al-Ali learnt about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health. Some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes three safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. Three rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach. Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important, as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role. I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, can I go inside? It's not mine. No, it's not mine. You can go in. I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Desbordes has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRAD.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally, either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed and who collect the scrap metal and cut it up, or housewives who sometimes recycle the metal to make pots that they'll subsequently cook in. Do you think there's a risk?
There are potential effects, especially if there's repeated exposure, even if it's not chronic. And this will be the case. Children come to play, water is cooked in the pots. With ingestion, with repeated administration within the body, even if you only have weak doses, The fact of accumulating the various doses can ultimately have an effect on health.
Clearly, the depleted uranium dust falls down, and it settles.
Yes. Once it falls, obviously the ground will be contaminated. Afterwards, it depends on how this contamination comes about, if it's very localized or not, and whether it's in towns or in fields which will be cultivated. So there will definitely be a contamination of the environment.
Things are becoming clearer to me, and more worrying. The depleted uranium particles are dangerous for health and for nature. The career of depleted uranium munitions began in Iraq, but it continued in the heart of Europe, just a few hours by air from capital cities like Paris, Rome, and Berlin. I walk among the graves in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. It was from here that Serbian snipers kept the besieged city locked down. The journalists, who, like myself, came to cover the conflict, often found themselves behind the yellow walls of the Holiday Inn. In 1992, divisions in Yugoslavia forced Bosnia into a war. In April, the inhabitants of Sarajevo were trapped. The UN launched an impossible mission to reconcile Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But the war dragged on, and in 1995, NATO intervened. NATO planes, mostly American, bombed the Serbs, who were forced to make peace. The Sniper Alley tramway takes me to Hadići, a suburb on the outskirts of Sarajevo. I enter a ruined factory, a key element in the Serbs' military industry. Tanks and cannons were repaired here. NATO planes attacked the Hadići factory 7 times in September 1995. And fired more than 4,000 depleted uranium shells. When peace was reinstated, many Serbs from Hadići moved to Bratunac, a Serbian republic town in eastern Bosnia. They went there to live and also to die. Nedeljko Zelenović is a journalist and a witness. He has investigated the NATO bombings. His father, uncle, cousins, and dozens of friends worked in the Hadići factory.
All the workers who worked on the assembly lines at the time, who were caught in the fighting, and later at the time I was following events, they all died from various forms of cancer. In 1996, the population of Bratunac was between 20 and 22,000 people. And less than 5% of them came from Hadići. That year, in 1996, 154 people were buried in the Bratunac municipal cemetery. 3% of them came from Hadići. But in 2000, 105 people were buried in Bratunac, and 50% of them came from Hadići. I have a few names if you're interested.
Jerić Budimir, Andrić Drago, Mastrilo Dušan, Banduka Milinko, Banduka Danilo, Aleksić Nenad, Makajić Simo, Stanojević Relja, Puša Ramon, Turuntaš Ljubica, Lavušić Gospod, Udurić.
What did your son die of?
He was diagnosed with leukemia. I asked what it was caused by. And they told me it was due to depleted uranium.
Mehmed Telalevich is a Muslim. During the war, he fled Hadice, driven out by the Serbs. In 1996, he returned home, close to the ruins of the arms factory. He found his house, blown apart by bombs. Mehmed rebuilt it, not suspecting that the land around it had been contaminated by poisonous dust.
We were never told. Nobody ever said anything. The public at large can't even be aware of it, as this disease is really a lottery. You put up with it, you fight it, and you might live or die. I know at least 10 people here, all young, aged between 35 and 40. They all have a cancer.
Mehmet tells me that he discovered he had colon cancer in 2004. He's taken chemotherapy and is now in remission. But the news is not good. The latest tests reveal that his prostate is 4 times bigger than normal. He has blood in his urine.
I've become fragile. Before I could take normal showers, but now I have to have very, very hot showers. I have to wear leggings. I'm cold all the time. I'm delicate. My blood is anemic. I've no immunity.
Are you sure all this is because of the factory?
Oh yes, I'm 100% certain. There are no other diseases here apart from cancer.
I pursue the depleted uranium trail in Italy. A great ally of the USA within NATO, the country organized humanitarian missions in Bosnia. It later sent a strong contingent to separate Serbs and Albanians in Kosovo. And it was in Italy that the dangers of depleted uranium weapons were widely exposed in late 1999. In Rome, I meet another Italian soldier who'd been sent to the Balkans. Colonel Americo Lacetti.
So it began in 1999.
I came back in 1999, and on December 24th, I had an X-ray. I remember I was alone with the technician. There was nobody at the hospital. When I asked him what I had, he said, "What have you got?" And then he said, "Enjoy Christmas, because you won't be here next year." I had this lump, 24 centimeters long, 14 centimeters wide, and 12 centimeters thick. A tumor in my lungs. After that, I had other tests, and they took a piece of the tumor and examined it. Inside were numerous ceramic particles, perfectly round. And they contained a load of substances that don't exist naturally. But they do exist when a depleted uranium projectile strikes a hard surface. This produces a cloud of dust, which when you inhale it, creates this type of pathology. I'm now living in a body that's mined.
As the death toll builds in Italy, the public is outraged, and the government has to act. On January the 3rd, 2001, the Prime Minister, Giuliano Amato, breaks the official silence and announces that he is going to demand a full account from NATO. But this demand will have little effect.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. You are listening to The Lantern only on IRIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of the show. Often I think about the habits I have. Like, it's a habit of mine to begin every show with Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Or when I come into the studio, the first thing I do is take off my shoes and fold my legs up onto the chair. It's our producer's habit to play chess on the computer. It's my brother has a habit where every time he is playing with his phone, he has to chew on the bottom of his pen or the corner of his... He has to chew on something. And when we think about it, we all have these sort of habits in our lives. How does this have to do anything with anything? Well, let's listen to a short story, and you guys are going to get what exactly it is that I'm talking about. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, dear friends, salam. So welcome to this program entitled Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story. What's the title of that? The Wise Old Man. A wealthy man requested an old scholar to wean his son away from his bad habits. The scholar took the youth for a stroll through a garden. Stopping suddenly, he asked the boy to pull out a tiny plant growing there. The youth held the plant between his thumb and forefinger and pulled it out. The old man then asked him to pull out a slightly bigger plant. The youth pulled hard and the plant came out, roots and all. "Now pull out that one," said the old man, pointing to a bush. The boy had to use all his strength to pull it out. "Now take this one out," said the old man, indicating a guava tree. The youth grasped the trunk and tried to pull it out, but it would not budge. "It's impossible," said the boy, panting with the effort. "So it's with bad habits," said the sage. "When they are young, it's easy to pull them out, but when they take hold, they can't be uprooted." The session with the old man changed the boy's life. And of course, we learn 1.2. Don't wait for bad habits to grow in you. Drop them while you have control over it, else they will get control of you.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
The thing about habits is that almost anything can become a habit of ours. Even anger. There's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam where His Eminence has said, "Do not rush in being enraged, because it will verily control you as a habit." If becoming angry is the first solution that I can think of every time something goes against my desire, every time things don't work out as I planned, every time I get upset about something, becoming angry is the first thing I do, It's the first thing I allow myself to resort to. Then after a while, it just becomes a default setting within myself. And perhaps that's what habits really are. Habits are default settings. Something that we turn to as a second nature. There is actually a narration from one of the infallibles that refers to habits as a second nature. Al-Ada Tab'un Than. Habits are our second nature. So it's really important for us to focus on positive, productive, contributing things that elevate our status, elevate our position, whether it's our position among our peers, fellow human beings, whether it's our spiritual position, our position in the eyes of God. We actively try to cultivate habits that would help that growth, that would help us become better people. Those habits, and that can happen through practice, obviously. Habits are something that we collect through the course of weeks, months, maybe even years, and it becomes our personality. A person who finds happiness, a person who finds company in a good book, didn't wake up one morning and decide to become a bookworm. That person spent probably their entire childhood and their teen years while everyone else was, you know, playing video games and going to prom and, I don't know, going bowling on the weekends or something like that. Not that there's anything wrong with it as long as the halal and haram limits are observed. But while their peers were doing that, this person spent their time reading books. I have a lot of friends who are bookworms, and they really did not have a social life during their teen years and their preteen years. Sure, there's always the risk of them becoming socially awkward, but we have a hadith that says, with books, whoever finds company with books is never alone, is never lonesome, because they're so accessible. And my point is that the person who became a bookworm didn't become a bookworm overnight. They spent years of their lives reading their nose in a book and finding comfort and solace in the writings and the prints on those woody papers. As is with every other habit in our lives, if a person is an early bird, it's not something that happened overnight. Obviously, they spent a good portion of their youth trying to sleep early, waking up early so that they could achieve more, so that they could be more refreshed during the day and their brain would function properly, because nothing helps the human body and mind and soul like a good night's sleep. Everything is possible through training, through discipline, through years of practice, and making that thing our habit, thus our second nature, our body's default system, what our mind refers itself to first opportunity it gets when it's faced with a situation. If it's my habit to curse, if it's my habit to say bad things when I'm alone, something falls and I cuss, something breaks and I curse, something irritates me and I utter a foul word, there could always be the argument that, well, there's no one around to hear me say these bad things. But it becomes my habit. It becomes who I am. It becomes my second nature, my default system. And once I'm in society, once I have children, it will automatically, my brain will switch to that setting when it is triggered by certain situations. I spend all my time when I'm alone, something bad happens, something falls, something startles me. The first thing I do, I cuss. When it happens in public as well, the first thing my mind is going to do is, you know, refer to the first cuss word that comes up in it, pops up. And then when I'm embarrassed once or twice, I will realize that, okay, probably this was not a very good habit for me to pick up, even if I picked it up in the privacy of my own home. So many other habits that we can think about. Perhaps the worst of it is, I don't know, smoking. I'm sure we all know a lot of people who do that. And the first cigarette might have happened overnight, but they did not become a smoker overnight. Again, it's something that happened through time. Thank you for being with us on The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.